So I'd like to introduce our speaker today. Our topic is, it's okay to ask questions. Our guest speaker today is Rabbi Jeremy Parnes, the spiritual leader of the Beth Jacob Synagogue here in Regina. Rabbi Jeremy was educated in England, where he specialized in creative approaches to community development with an emphasis on low-income and social housing. He has chaired and sat on a large number of inner-city boards and committees, too numerous to mention if we want to leave time for him to speak today. Along with his work in the Regina community, Rabbi Jeremy is chair of the board of an international Jewish outreach organization, Aleph, Alliance for Jewish Renewal. Today, Rabbi Jeremy will give us some insights into the Jewish religion. Unlike some religions, the Jewish faith allows for a culture of curiosity and questioning. What does it mean to be open to debate, to wrestle with our questions, rather than to just accept what we are told? Rabbi Jeremy, I'll turn it over to you.
Good morning, everybody. It's an honor for me to be able to be here this morning, and thank you. I know this isn't my first time here, and so I feel like I'm amongst friends. The topic that I was asked to speak about was the concept of argument, questioning, really. This just recently we ended our High Holy Day period, which lasts about 3.5 weeks. As I commented to a friend of mine who's a minister in one of the churches in town, it's sort of like Christmas on steroids. It's a lot. And during that period, I wrote six sermons, all in sort of one after the other, starting with a sermon that was entitled Machlochet L'Shem Shamayim, which means argument for the sake of heaven. The idea being that what's the right kind of argument and what's the wrong kind of argument? In our testament, in the Hebrew text, in the five books of Moses, we have this character that appears whose name is Korach. Korach is a member of the Levite tribe, and he challenges the leadership, Moses and his brother Aaron, saying, who are you that you've decided that you're the leader here? We're all holy in the eyes of God. I have as much right to leadership as you do. And so when the rabbis discuss the whole concept of collegial debate, if I can use those terms, they question whether Korach, in fact, was arguing for the sake of heaven, for the benefit of all, is essentially how I understand that, and concluded that he wasn't. He had his own agenda. His agenda was, I want power, and so I'm going to go fight for it and try to take it. He did not fare well, neither did his followers in that particular instance. So they had, with our rabbis 1,000 years ago, had a lot of discussion about the concept of how do you do this. And of course, the answer was, you start off by doing it for the right reasons, with the right intent. And that means, of course, in modern terms, you park your ego at the door and get on with what's going on. Easier said than done. And in fact, it does create difficulty in the modern world today. Because we have many more voices than we ever had before with social media and things like that. However, you talked about wrestling with the issues. The term Israel, Yisraeli, is a term that was quoted initially in the Hebrew text, in the five books of Moses, when Jacob was reported to have wrestled with what we believe to be a man, a messenger, an angel of God. It's not really, doesn't absolutely define it. and that he wouldn't let him go. And the angel's going, oh, whatever this being was, said, you have to let me go. It's the dawn is coming. I cannot be here any longer. And Jacob wisely said, okay, give me something and I'll let you go, because he wouldn't release him. So the angel said, from now on, you will no longer be Jacob, Yaakov. You will be Yisrael, because you wrestled with God and man, and you prevailed. We're God wrestlers. And in truth, as Jews, we are God wrestlers. We question everything, including God, no question about it, and each other. They say that if there's two Jews in the room, there's three points of view and three arguments. So, and that is absolutely the case. But it is done, hopefully, the right way for the right reasons most of the time. And I can give you a classic example of that today, or at least until a couple of weeks ago. There has been an attempt by the government, which is an extremely strong right-wing government, including very extreme right-wing members of the Orthodox parties, that have been trying to pass laws to change the power of the judiciary. This is scary, very scary, because we do not have a constitution in Israel. So without the judiciary, that basically puts everything, all the power, into the hands of the government or the leadership of that time. As someone once said, power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I fear that that may be part of what's going on. So, what do we do in a situation like that with a majority government, even though it's coalesced as a majority government, and the people in large numbers don't agree? If you read the papers at all, the Israeli papers, which is, I don't expect you to do, but I do, of course, they have been demonstrating in the streets of Israel for 44 weeks against judicial reform. I don't know another country in the world where they would do that. I know that in the United States, when they do that, they start by burning cars, breaking windows, looting stores. When they get angry, they just run through the streets. We've seen it. It's happened. That has not happened in Israel. The government has not acquiesced to the will of the people. And I'm talking people in the tens of thousands and greater than that, every single day for 44 weeks. Okay? And that hasn't happened. This violence of that nature has not happened. So much so that at one point the government put a hold and said, okay, time out, let's give this a break. And then they started to break it down and they introduced a preliminary that passed. The law that they have now passed, which is a preliminary law, passed by a majority of 64-0. And the reason why it passed by a majority of 64-0 is because everybody else who wasn't in the government walked out. They didn't cast a vote. They walked away. So, I mean, this is democracy at its pinnacle. And you could say you're best at its best and in some ways at its worst, depending on how you understand this. But it gives you a sense of the Jewish tendency towards these things. And we don't give up and we don't let go. So Yisrael, Israel, the term comes from its root. El meaning God, Yisra comes from the Yashar, which means upright. Biblically speaking, just a little bit of Torah study if I may, that name that was given to Jacob, whose Hebrew name, if you could bring it back to its Hebrew origin, is Yaakov. So if you know anything about Jacob, he dressed himself up in rough animal skins, so that he would appear to his father who was blind, his father Isaac, as if he was his brother Esau, in order to steal his brother's birthright. And the reason he was stealing it is because his mother had been told that it would be his birthright. But she was in great fear that her husband, who saw Esau as his favorite, he was a hunter, he made food for him, he treated him well, nothing wrong with that, but he favored him as a result, his oldest. And she feared that he would give that blessing to him and when it should have gone to Jacob, rather than having faith and just let it happen. And so what happened was that he stole his brother's blessing. By the way, I can give you a whole Torah study to show you how he ended up giving it all back to his brother. It's written in the text, and that you don't want to miss it, but a lot of people miss it. Anyway, what's interesting about this is that the name Yaakov relates to Akev. Okay? And he was called Yaakov, coming from Akev, because they were twins, and he was born just after his brother. But they say that when he came out of the womb, he was clutching his brother's heel as if to be the firstborn. Okay? Because if you read the text again, they were warring inside her belly. Hopefully you don't have twins in there right now. I don't want to disturb you. Okay, so there's your story. Okay? And the reason they call him Yaakov, because he was clutching his brother's heel. Akev means heel. But more realistically, heel, in this case, comes from the word akev, which means these little rivulets, these little... When you walk in the sand, as you do this with your heel, you create... Right? And that's what heel means. And... He had done, what's in a name? His character. He stole his brother's birthright. He was a heel. It's really simple. The two come together. He was a heel. He had to leave home. He ran away from home because his brother would kill him if he got a hold of him. He spent 20 years living with his mother's uncle, his mother's brother, his uncle, who also was a heel. He deceived him a couple of times. First of all, he fell in love with his younger daughter, Rachel. On the night of the wedding, Lavan, his uncle, got him nicely drunk. And when he sealed the deal, he was actually sealing it with the older sister, Leah. And when he realized what had happened, when he woke up in the morning and he came round, he was furious, of course, but his uncle said, well, no, it's real simple. In our tradition, you never marry the younger until the older is married. That's just the way it is, right? And so I'll tell you what, we agreed to let you work 7 years for my daughter, Rachel. You'll work another 7 years for my daughter, Leah. It'll be fine. And you can marry her now. And still work the 7 years, right? So that's how it was. So he ended up working 14 years, and then more, of course, and he developed his own herds, etc. 20 years in, he had to leave. He realized that this was not going to get any better. So they go away. And he is due to meet again with his brother after 20 years. And he spends the night across the Yabok River, and he goes to sleep, and he has a dream, which is where he ends up wrestling with this figure. So you can see that opens up to all kinds of possible conversations, arguments, discussions. I mean, we're just filled with discussion, with argument, with disagreement and agreement and discourse. But in the end, he gets the name Yisrael. So he went from being a heel, Yaakov from Akev, to being Yisrael from Yashar, a stand-up dude. And it was the next day that he met with his brother and actually returned to him his blessing. That's another story for another time. But it's interesting when you do it this way, okay? And you break it down. So, I think I've covered the reality that we question everything, including God. We argue with God all the time. And between you and me, I think God can take it. So, somebody said to me, well, do you believe in God? I said, sometimes, not always. How about you? And they're going, well, how could you even say that? And I'm going, well, it's because it's the truth. It's how I feel. I'm a flawed human being, I guess, but that's the way it is. And I'm going to keep questioning, because I've figured it out that the more you question these things with the right intent, the deeper and stronger becomes your faith, your beliefs, and the better you can become as a human being, especially if you can share and argue with others who come at it the same way. What makes it difficult is when you're dealing with someone with hidden agenda, their own particular decisions as to agendas as to what they want to see in life. So there's no clear way to argue. And when I concluded the piece that I wrote about argument, the last line to my congregation just before the beginning of the Jewish New Year, when we would then go, because I wrote the whole thing was a series of sermons based on this theme. The next sermon would start with the last line of the last sermon, which is it possible for truth and peace to coexist? Yeah. I figured it was time to really grapple with that. Thank you for asking me if I still wanted to come today under the circumstances. It has been extremely busy, stressful, very stressful. Anxious, I have family in Jerusalem. I have students in Jerusalem. I know people who have lost loved ones in Israel. So it's a difficult time, but I don't think that's a good enough reason not to be here and discuss, talk to you, and if necessary, argue with you. In fact, I welcome the opportunity to argue. I think it's a great idea. I'm teaching that to my students, by the way. So, and when I go out to schools where I'm asked to speak about Judaism, I get into the whole idea of argument. Why? Especially now for our youth. Because we're living in a world where you want the answer to a question? Any one of our young people can give you the answer in 0.002 whatever it is of a second. They go to what I call Rabbi Google, and they can have the answer to any question. Sounds great, but as I say to those students, how do you know it's the truth? How do you do that? Are you being taught how to figure out, how to learn, how to tell the difference between truth and falsehood? Have you been taught how to stop being told, because I said so, do as you're told? Enough questions, just do it, right? As opposed to what now needs to be more than ever. You have to, critical pedagogy is absolutely essential today. Serious questioning. And the problem is that if you haven't been brought up with that, you got a problem. Questions, first of all, you need to learn to ask the questions. That's the science. The art is to learn to ask the right questions. Right? Those are both valid. But you've got to start off by teaching the kids, hey, what you're reading, what you're seeing on Google isn't necessarily the truth. And the way that I explain that to them or bring it into some kind of context is by asking them if they know how Google got its name. Does anybody know how Google got its name? No?
No.
Okay. Google took its name from a number. The number is Googleplex. And you can look it up. I get them. I say it now. Before you look it up on Google, just take my word for it. But then we'll verify, because you got to verify everything. That's the first thing you got to keep in your mind. But it's a Googleplex, which is this infinite number. It's something to the power of 10. It just right. So then I ask them. So if it's Googleplex, how do you spell Googleplex? Googleplex. No, that's wrong. Googleplex is spelled Googleplex. So the company that gives you all of this reliable information does not know how to spell its own name. Or at least did not know at that time, but chose to keep it anyway, which is a fair comment. Now you've done it. What are you going to do? Right? So you stick with it. It's a way of getting their attention. And then we can get into discussion. And for my students, when I bring them into the Hebrew high school class, actually prior to that, when they're going to study with me for Bar Mitzvah and Bat Mitzvah, coming of age, like a confirmation, I now have a new curriculum. The curriculum is a blank page. And I invite them to ask, to write down all of the questions they may have about God, Judaism, any of that stuff. Whatever it is that you want to know the answer to, write it down. And whatever it is you don't know if you want to know or not, but you're curious, write it down. And those form the foundation of the discussions, the questions that we then go forward with. It's been very helpful. Because what I'm finding is that if you're asking the questions, you're more likely going to listen to the answers, right? And I don't give them the answers. I get them to research it. And then we discuss it. Gets us right into the whole concept of questioning and argument, right? It's been working pretty well. So the nice thing about that is that every one of my students comes to my Hebrew high school class the year after their Bar Mitzvah. Like after they finish the Bar Mitzvah, then it's Hebrew High if you want to come. You're not obliged to. And the classes have been growing, which is great. And it's based on their discussions, which is even better. It's working. It's working. So do you have questions? How am I doing for time? I forgot to look at the clock. Can't believe I did that. Okay. I promise I'll be done by next Wednesday. Okay, so I obviously I don't want to drag it out, but you may have questions about what's going on.
I'm just grabbing the microphone to carry it around.
Oh, good idea. You may have questions about what's going on and what we're doing about it. I will tell you this while that microphone is going around. Think of some questions, any questions. I just said we are an argumentative bunch, but we are also curious, and we're also interested in inviting others to join us in this. The only way we're going to resolve and change things really is if we speak to each other. Somebody asked to me, I said, I've got the solution, by the way. Somebody said, you've got the solution? I said, absolutely. And this is based on my research. And the solution is, let's have coffee. I absolutely believe in that solution. As trite as it sounds, it is the solution. And how did that come? 2018, I spent 3.5 weeks in Israel. I was in Jerusalem, in Talpiot, and from there we spent time and stayed in the West Bank, a group of rabbis, and we met with Palestinian activists in the West Bank, and we talked about all of this. And it was behind closed locked doors with no recording or cameras because they were very frightened that their leadership would find out about it. So we had to make it as discreet as possible, but they were brave enough to come, and we spoke with them. And one of the things they said to me that I hadn't considered, because they're living in the West Bank, and the one guy turned around to me and he said, do you know how many Jews, how many Israelis our people in the West Bank have met out of uniform? Almost none.
Oh.
We don't think about that. Right? There's many who go into Israel and work, everything's great, but the ones that don't, they have no connection. They're siloed into that area and they only see military, IDF. That's all they see. So that's the first issue. It's a problem because the more that we, let me put it in modern terms, the more that we confine ourselves to our echo chambers, I believe they're called nowadays, to narrow casting instead of broadcasting, the more we become fearful and live in fear. And the more we live with only what we know within our group, we only know what we want to hear. We don't want to hear the other stuff. We just want to believe in what we believe, which is a problem. Because if you believe that, and if you believe what you believe is the truth, back to truth and peace, you've got a problem. As I said in my next sermon that in that period, there is truth. Truth exists in heaven. On earth, there are truths, many of them. And the only way that you take the jigsaw puzzle of truths and make them work is by starting to work out the pieces of the puzzle. And you can only do that by doing it with each other. So that was the first thing that I learned in the West Bank. Then I went and we spoke with the executive director of the Bethlehem of the Trust in Bethlehem, the Holy Trust, and the Holy Land Trust, I think it's called. And he made the second point. And the second point was, everybody here, whether you're in Israel or in the West Bank, it doesn't matter, in this part of the region, everybody here is suffering from PTSD. Of course. But we don't discuss that. We don't allow for it. We don't consider that possibility. Problem number two. And then the third one. We then met with a guide who took us around Eastern Jerusalem, which is predominantly Arab-Israeli. And they're not happy with the Israeli government. They're not happy with how they are treated. It isn't fun for them. And this guy was very outspoken about it. And we were respectful and we listened. And then afterwards we went back to a hotel, an older hotel that's been there for many years, for coffee, just to be together. And we sat together and I said to this guy, I hear everything you've said. I respect your point of view coming from where you are. I presume that if we ever see a two-state solution, you can then have a Palestinian passport. You can be with your people, with your government, and you can live in better... Oh, God, he said, I don't want to be Palestinian. I don't want the Palestinian government looking after me. God forbid. I'll stay as an Israeli. I just wish the government would treat me better. That gave me a very different understanding of that reality. So that was number three. So for me, this was all about perspectives. And that's when I came to the idea or the conclusion, clearly, that the only way to change this, because the problem is we keep talking about, we've got to stop this, we've got to have peace. What's the opposite of peace? Someone. War. If I say peace, you say war. Where did the word peace come from? Its origin is Pax Romana, from the Latin, which is Roman peace. You know what Roman peace is? What happened to Israel? You do as you're told, you pay your taxes, we'll be at peace. I'm sorry, but that's its origin. It's a horrible word. I hate it. I think I spoke to it once when I came here. Okay, so what we need is to recognize my background is community development. There's a whole dance that people need to do together to get to know each other before we can do anything that comes close to being at peace. Or at least in shalom. Because shalom doesn't mean peace. It means wholeness, completion, imbalance. In balance, not imbalance. Okay? Balanced. Right? It means those things. And so the only way we can do that is by having the discussions, the arguments, the fights. And ultimately we come from, well, we've got two choices. We can live in the past and everything that's happened and everything you did to me and I did to you, and we can hate each other and we can blow each other up. Or we can say, we did those things. There's got to be a better way. Let's get it together and do that. But there's a process that will bring us there. And what's going on there right now isn't that process. It's just not. And we can go back and forth with who said what, who did what. I can give you history if you like. In fact, it really doesn't matter that I know the history, because it becomes he said, she said. So I think one of the things that I've been telling people that I believe to be a real truth is that people do not make reasoned, logical decisions. Now, that's got to grate against you a little bit. They don't. We make emotive choices, emotive decisions. They're emotion-based, and then we support them with logic and reason. That's how we generally function as human beings. I challenge you to think about that, and then you can challenge me with pleasure, because then maybe we can go a bit deeper with it. But that's what I believe to be the truth. Any questions? Here's one right there.
Okay.
So I think my immediate challenge to you, Rabbi, would be this. I mean, is there any question or significant question to which the answer the answer is not love at the end of it. Is there any significant question to which the answer is not love?
The short answer is no. The answer is love, ultimately. But love without justice doesn't work. Unconditional love is a bad idea. It's kind of scary, actually. And I have biblical texts to support that, obviously. But yeah, so it's a good question, and it's a hard one, because love keeps getting trumped by fear. Yeah. Therein lies your problem. And we have to overcome that. And that's a big problem, because Israel spends its life defending itself. And from Israel's perspective, that's what we're doing. We're defending ourselves justifiably, reasonably, etc., etc., except that at some point, someone has to take the first step to put down the gun and not shoot back. Someone has to. We're not there yet. Because, so I was at the Tower of God. Does anybody know what the Tower of God is? Powerful name, eh? Tower of God. Wow. I never heard of it. It's in Wilcox, Saskatchewan at Notre Dame College. Father Athol Murray had a vision, a dream, that he was going to build a Tower of God in Jerusalem. He went to Jerusalem to do that. It didn't work out, but he built a Tower of God at Notre Dame. The example of what it would be, with a wall there dedicated to Islam, a wall there dedicated to Christianity, and a wall there dedicated to Judaism. And the fourth wall has famous quotes from great people. It's a wonderful concept. Wonderful. I was there for the first time Thursday morning, with the Archbishop Don Bolan and His Royal Highness Prince Turki Al Faisal from Saudi Arabia, who had come at the invitation of Paul Hill. And so Paul had called me and said, I want you to come. Don's going to be here and the prince is going to be here. I want you guys to sit down and talk about this vision of a Tower of God. Is it a good idea? And how does it feel in present circumstances? Because this was planned long before what's happening now. But now this is happening. It's kind of hard to avoid it. We didn't make the conflict the center of it all. But it did somehow, unsurprisingly, in some places get in. What was interesting for me was that the prince referred to Hamas as spoilers. And I kind of like that term, actually. The more I heard it, the more I kind of thought about it, the more I liked it. Because there are people living in Gaza, there are people living in the West Bank, and of course there are people living in Israel who are innocent victims of all of this and who want to simply just live their lives in community, in peace. But there are those who would be the spoilers and not allow that to happen. What Hamas has intended and is doing and has been doing from its beginning, its very charter, is to destroy the people of Israel, the Jews. And not just in Israel. Their charter is to get rid of Jews. It's written into the charter. It's how they exist. The concern for Israel has always been, why would the Palestinian people elect Hamas to the leadership if they want a two-state solution and be at peace? Hamas is not interested in a two-state solution. That's why we don't have any two-state solution or even any negotiation. It is not in their interest. They simply want to get rid of us. It's not even a state issue is the problem. I'm sorry, but that's what I believe to be my truth. How's that? Okay? And I'm open to any arguments, and we'll go look up their charter, and we'll figure out what they actually say about themselves. By the way, the word Hamas in Hebrew means violence. I have no idea if they took it from there or what, or if there's an equivalent in the Arabic language, but that's what it means. So yeah, love would be a good idea. I could use some right now. Hugs, also good. Any other questions?
Yes, I always wonder about the children. I mean, the children are affected by the war, and how do they survive, and that sort of thing. I mean, those poor children on either side are probably being they're being indoctrinated in the beliefs and ways of the side on which they're on. And yet children are malleable and you just let them go. They'll all be on the soccer field playing together, no matter what. But exactly. It's us older people that keep disturbing their peace.
Absolutely. So, and the answer to that is you're right. They are malleable, and it is possible for this to change, even in this time, with that generation, with those children, they can change. They can be allowed to live differently. We have schools in Israel run by a group called Hand in Hand. The children are both, there are Israelis and Arabs going to schools, the families, and they continue to do that throughout. All of the conflicts, their children still do that. They have their children there because they believe that this solution is a different solution than what's going on. So you have children in schools in Israel learning both Hebrew and Arabic, learning the subjects together, Israeli and Arab, side by side. It's really cool. I have a book that I used and studied with as part of our process before we went to Israel as this group back in 2018 called Side by Side. And the book has, on one page is the Israeli narrative to a particular event, and on the other page is the Palestinian narrative to a particular event. And I have to tell you, we studied that book for a year before we went to Israel. And there were several times where I was ready to close the book and walk away. It's hard to hear what the other side believes and says, especially when in many cases you know it not to be the truth. Somebody said, well, that's their truth. Here we go, right? And I'm going, I get that. But when we talk about the 1967 Six-Day War, I was in Israel in June 1967. I was there. I saw the news was reported very differently in the UK back in those days. We heard it all. And there's documentation as well, so I know. And there were things that were said which simply weren't true. And then there were things that Israel did that were the worst thing they could have done. Because basically, we now have the history that we have to live with today. It would have been better if we hadn't done that, in my opinion. But it's done. What am I going to do? Go back and change it? No. I'm going to go forward in the hope that we can make it better, do a better job. So yeah, but the children can change. One of the things that surprised me, as a rabbi studying, I have to study not just the Torah, the Hebrew text, but also Talmud, which is all these commentaries and questions. People come to the courts and say, this is what it says, but how do we do that in this day and age? And the rabbis would discuss it and figure it out and come up with solutions. So we have to discuss that. Well, the Talmud Bavli, which is the primary authority on all of that of texts, is in Aramaic, because they were in Babylonia for many years. Actually, we were only exiled to Babylonia after the destruction of the first temple for 70 years. And then a remnant came back, but a whole bunch stayed out and continued because they'd been there 70 years. They've established their lives there. We're talking three generations, essentially. What's interesting about that is, so what happened? It was only 70 years. How come they're speaking Aramaic instead of Hebrew? Because that was the other original language. And then, about 15 years ago, we started to get Israeli families moving into Regina, which for me right now is another issue, because you can imagine how they feel right now and what their narrative is and what they want to do about it. And it's not pretty in some cases. We've got some hotheads there. And I've got to figure out how to deal with that. I have a plan, but we'll see if it works. But the bottom line is, they came here. I have children who came at 6 years of age, living in Regina, who I bar mitzvahed, who actually, I was in Ottawa Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday at a conference on anti-Semitism, Face It and Fight It, and how to address it. With and up on the hill meeting with MPs, And the keynote speakers on the last night was the Prime Minister, the Leader of the Opposition, Pierre Poilievre, and Jagmeet Singh. All three spoke at that keynote evening. Very interesting. The point is, one of the young ladies who came with us to that program was one of my students, and one of the students that I had taught her at Bat Mitzvah, Linoy. She can't speak Hebrew anymore. She speaks perfect English. You see what I'm saying? That's how quick it happens.
Yeah.
No time flat. Unless you instill it and insist at home. But many of the families that came from Israel to Regina had originally gone to Israel from Russia and Ukraine. Imagine that. Russian and Ukrainian families who lived in Israel together, now in Regina, and now we have Russia and Ukraine fighting. And within those families, it's not pretty. There's some issues there as well. But they speak Russian or Ukrainian at home. The kids learn English at school. Hebrew gets lost. Doesn't take long. So it is possible to change the equation for the next generations quickly.
Okay, yeah. I'm going to cut off
okay,
the discussion
now.
No. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah.